Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important trends in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Onofuaka.
This week, the FCC hears your net neutrality concerns, Twitter gets less tweety, Dogecoin suffers much hack, so heist, why Apple may be banking on Beats Audio, the Google court ruling that could change the web, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com. Our subscription links are in our show notes. And leave us a review on iTunes if you like the show. We'd love to hear from you. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines today, we usually do a segment of the show we call What We're Playing With. Today we're going to mix it up a little bit, and we're going to do a segment called What's Your Favorite Tech Thing This Week, which is basically, you know, each of us are going to talk about one of our favorite stories that we new tech stories from the week, in addition to the headlines that we'll be talking about later on in the show. So I'm mixing it up a little bit. I guess I'll start here. The thing that I liked, one of the things that I liked most this week that I heard about is that Xbox Live, which had traditionally had charged Xbox Live, required users to pay for an Xbox Live Gold subscription to access basic services like Netflix and Hulu, Xbox has removed those restrictions. They're officially removing those restrictions for Netflix, Hulu, and YouTube. In other words, now if you have an Xbox, you can access the same online channels that you can access for free on other platforms such as Roku, Chromecast, and basically most net connected media devices nowadays have access to those for free, and now you don't have to pay for those anymore on Xbox Live, which is the way it should be. They're basically following suit. They're making up for it's been so long that they've asked you to pay for those services through Xbox Live Gold account, that finally they're saying, hey, this is the reality of the world we're living in. People expect those services for free.
Yeah, no, it's a good change for them, especially because that was one of the reasons why I stopped paying for Gold, because I had a PlayStation and I realized I wasn't really playing games on my Xbox, just watching Netflix, and I could do it for free on my PlayStation. So finally getting back in line. And I guess speaking of another change from Microsoft,
this is your favorite?
Yeah, my favorite story of the week is Xbox Kinect is going to be dropped as a requirement for purchasing an Xbox One. So Microsoft has officially said that they'll start selling it for the same price point as a new PlayStation. So that would be $400 rather than the additional $100 with the Kinect. And this to me was a big move, because throughout the past year, Microsoft has continually said that this was a required, it was part of the ecosystem and the architecture of the Xbox One, and that it's not considered a separate system, part of that same platform ecosystem, as well as they've been reiterating that they've had no plans to break it up. But I think this is another one of those moves where they realize that they're losing a good part of the market due to the price, and currently there just aren't that many or any really you know, must have games that require the Kinect. It's more about the voice automation if anyone has that. So that is my story of the week.
That's interesting because I feel like that's the reason why they'd want Kinect on everything is to get the developers to develop develop all their games for Kinect. So now developers don't even have to think about Kinect if they don't want to. I wonder. It just makes you wonder what was going on in Microsoft headquarters. Part of me thinks that, you know, Ballmer was so hardcore on his positions.
Yeah.
And now that the new CEO's in and the new CEO is having his druthers about things, he's taking a look at some of these procedures and saying, what's the market doing? Let's do what the market's doing to get the most share. Let's not be outside of the convention when it comes to paying for, you know, Xbox Live to get to your own Netflix subscription or forcing people to get Kinect. What if they don't have a 10-foot space in the living room?
Do you see it as an admission of failure of Kinect, not as a technology, but as a basically as a game accessory?
I don't know if Kinect is a failure. I do know that it's – I look at it and I think to myself, they haven't been able to – they haven't been able to refine Kinect to a point where developers are jumping on it first. Everyone chased the Wii back in the day, and that's why they got PS Move and Kinect and things like that. I think we might actually be moving back toward a sitting experience only because – with the Oculus and the stuff that Sony's doing, I think VR is going to be a very big thing. And I think because of that, the movement stuff might fall to the wayside. I think developers are more interested in VR than they are interested in trying to track movement. And the Kinect has a lot of potential for other applications if you go to Microsoft Labs and things like that.
It's like when, in the consumer space, when all the TV manufacturers jumped on the 3D bandwagon. And then literally a couple years later, they were like, well, you know, 3D is not that important anymore. Now it's 4K. 4K is the big thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Wait till 3D 4K comes out. Oh, yeah. God.
So Dwayne, what's your favorite tech story of the week?
It's Alibaba, not the not so much the guy who had the 40 thieves to deal with, but mostly the massive, massive company in China that is seeking a initial public offering.
So this is one of our top stories of last week's episode.
Mm-hmm. Alibaba does more business monetarily than Google, not Google, than well, probably definitely than Google by itself, but than Amazon and eBay combined. They own China's de facto PayPal system, Alipay. They own a consumer-based seller's market, a business-to-business-based seller's market. They own a lot of stuff.
I saw an article I think it was I don't remember where it was, but it was basically they compared Alibaba to the services that would be the equivalent services that a company would have to purchase or own to get everything that Alibaba has. And amongst the Alibaba holdings are companies that are like PayPal, Amazon Web Services, Google Play, Android, Google Maps, JCPenney, Groupon, Dropbox, WhatsApp, Uber, eBay, Orbitz, Amazon.com, Twitter, Spotify, Hulu, and Ing Direct. These are all companies that Alibaba has an equivalent service.
Counterpart of, service for. So the interesting thing is that there's not a lot of so it's a really big IPO opportunity, but at the same time, there's not a lot of transparency about what Alibaba owns and what they don't own. And there's also not a lot of transparency about dividends. So you guys remember Apple just gave a big dividend to its investors. With Alibaba, because it's China's state-run communist totalitarian regime, it's unclear whether the government will let Alibaba pay outside of the country investors a dividend at all. So it's this big IPO for this big company, but there's so much stuff shrouded in mystery that it's kind of something that many people are asking big questions about. So for me, it's just a really interesting story about the classic case of American engineering and ingenuity. You go over to China. An enterprising guy over there can look at everything we do and with his resources pull it off, right? Like, he doesn't have competition over there, so you can pull off Uber, you can pull off PayPal, you can do all these things. Hey, we can do that, is kind of his thing, and become a fantastic billionaire because of it. But at the end of the day, because it's China, when you look at the IPO situation, it's not a normal tech IPO because there's so many things you don't know about. So I thought that was interesting.
All right, let's move into our headlines for this week. The Federal Communications Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler is revising proposed rules for regulating broadband internet in an attempt to address criticism of his proposal unveiled last month, and we talked about it last week, I believe, that would ban broadband providers from blocking or slowing down websites but allow them to strike deals in which content companies could pay them for faster delivery of web content to consumers, essentially tearing down the concept of net neutrality.
Right. Right. Because he's not, you know, like, net neutrality, when you ask, like, if you look up what it really is, a Columbia professor came up with the term back in 08 or 07. So it's not like it's a core tenet of the internet originally, or at least it was never marketed as a core tenet of the internet when it first came out. It has since become that because it's really important. But what's really interesting is that, you know, we talked about the tech companies, 100 tech companies wrote in to the FCC and said, hey, this is whack, last week. In addition to that, the civil liberties unions have jumped in there, and a couple other big names and organizations have jumped with their own letters. So there is lashback not only from the public but from, you know, huge segments of the economy and, you know, job creators and all this other stuff. It's definitely an idea that is problematic. And if you think about how the internet runs, it runs on advertising. Advertising's biggest growth opportunity right now is online video. If you're on Hulu and that ad is supposed to come up and Hulu has to pay more to a Comcast to get the content and the ad over, that ad's going to cost more money, which means the person paying for that ad is going to have to pass that cost over to the consumer, which means the consumer gets screwed again, right?
Yeah.
Screwed again on cost, because they're going to get screwed by the cost of the advertiser and they're going to get screwed by the cost of that Hulu service going up. And all that money, all that cost the consumer's putting out there is going directly into Comcast pockets. So it's a strange thing, because the only person who wins is Comcast, right? The only person who wins is AT&T. If you go to the Foundry Group website right now, and you just check it out, they have a big tile, a series of tiles of all the companies that they're behind, like Fitbit and all these other tech companies that this Foundry Group has laid out. But before you even get there, there's a splash page, and it says, "Please wait while we deliver you the optimized experience based on Comcast Gold Plus service." Uh-huh. And as you look at that, it reloads and it says, "Click here." And then it basically has an anti-net neutrality statement on the front of it and the ability to petition the United States government.
It's a cautionary, like a cautionary tale website there.
Yeah, I don't recall if we spoke about this last week, but there was that whole NeoCities blog in which they started rate limiting the FCC to dial-up modem connections.
Oh, right.
Finergini plan, I think it was called.
Uh-huh.
Did you guys get to see that?
I think I did, yeah, as sort of like throwing it in the FCC's face.
Right, exactly. And so you can kind of – I'm not sure how much that led to the change, but given the sort of tech unity that we saw, I think that at least helped push the envelope a little bit more. I don't know if it's exactly to the point where everyone's comfortable, but it's far from them just simply giving in as that was seemed the case.
I think there's enough sort of public sentiment behind this that it's not just going to go slide through. It's not just going to get rubber stamped into law. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is one of those things. The options are obviously that they can reclassify these broadband providers as, you know, utilities, and that changes the game. But I think you're right. The whole thing here is that major sectors of the economy have come out and said, look, this is not okay. It's affecting everything. It's changing the game of business in a way that's negative. And I think that we'll see. Hopefully, we'll see something come of that. This is you know, a different approach than the PIPA, CISPA kind of backlash that came out a while ago. But I think it's possibly the beginning of some sort of lobbying attempt.
Yep. All right, moving on here. Twitter is introducing a way to silence noisy people you follow but aren't quite ready to unfollow. The option called Mute lets you hide the tweets and activity of selected accounts from your timeline. Muting someone, however, won't stop the person from being able to interact with your tweets, be it favoriting, replying, or retweeting. The fact that they're doing so just won't show up in your timeline, which can be a convenient way to temporarily muffle people who, for example, are live tweeting an event or giving an opinion that you don't much care about. Muting can be reversed at any time, and unlike a block, people won't know when they've been muted. I think that's a great idea, really. And to be honest, sometimes I will, on a rare occasion, I will live tweet something and I'll be sending out like dozens of tweets an hour. And I don't want people to be inundated with that unless they're really interested in that. So that's a great option.
I'm down. Yeah. I mean, I look at it and I think to myself, last Friday when one of John Gruber's surrogates was like, attacking me for not agreeing with John Gruber on like a very small point.
Oh yeah.
I was like, I don't need to see everything that this guy is pumping my way. Cause it doesn't matter what's said. He's just a big fan of John Gruber. Therefore he doesn't like me.
Yeah.
which is funny. Cause, you know, I kept on being called things like troll and everything, but I don't dislike John Gruber. I just disagreed with him on one thing, and muting would have come in very handy then. So unfortunately, the option is not going to be available for everybody until a few weeks from now.
Yeah,
but it is available for some people right now.
And there are other circumstances. For example, if someone you follow gets some sort of virus or malware that is tweeting tons of stuff, or there are occasions where a temporary mute would be handy.
Yeah. But I think it's a good addition. You know, Facebook already has a similar thing for individual posts where you can mute them from the timeline. So I think it's a good thing for Twitter to get onto. Okay, so you guys are familiar with Dogecoin, which is the cryptocurrency. Probably the second most popular cryptocurrency next to Bitcoin, and based on an internet meme involving a Shiba Inu dog. So kind of a weird sort of provenance for it to begin with. But Doge Vault is a popular online wallet where people can store and send Dogecoin. Apparently a user of Doge Vault reported that 950,000 Dogecoin were transferred out of his wallet before the site was taken online, and the people over at Doge Vault confirmed that that Doge Vault had in fact been hacked, which is the worst. It's basically the biggest hit to the Dogecoin community since its inception. At the same time that a number of users had reported that their Dogecoin had been transferred, a wallet had been traced with over 121 million Dogecoin in it, and 121 million Dogecoin is currently about $56,000. So a massive theft of $56,000 in the Dogecoin community. The biggest thing that I've had, the biggest sort of hurdle that I've had to buying any sort of cryptocurrency at all has been the reports of these vaults being broken into and the cryptocurrency being liberated without any sort of recourse. It's not like, when you're banking with real currency and there's the FDIC to insure your investments. If Dogecoin or Bitcoin gets stolen at this point, you're completely out. And I think that's probably going to be the biggest hurdle to the mass adoption of cryptocurrency until this particular problem is solved.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That's the issue. The SEC actually put out a statement basically warning people that there's no backup. If you go to invest in these things or you use these things to invest or whatever and their value plummets, there's no backup for you, which is pretty obvious, but you know, they had to say it eventually. Another thing they said was it's going to be pretty difficult to prosecute people who get people. So like if there's someone who gets you into Dogecoin, right? Yeah. They're like, oh, yeah, I'll sell you this. I'm making some promises, whatever. They mentioned that it's going to be pretty difficult to prosecute those people for fraud or anything because it's pretty clear those people believe what they're selling. They can't really prove bad intent or anything. So it's just they're in a strange place. They're in a pretty strange place. And there's no recourse. So, yeah, it's definitely incredibly risky. Only put out there what you can afford to put out there.
Yeah, yeah. I think eventually there will be some sort of security measures in place in the future to prevent thefts like this from happening in the cryptocurrency community. And that's when I think I will feel safe enough to jump in and put some of my real money, quote-unquote real money, into it.
Indeed.
All right. So this is the next story is fairly interesting. Europe's highest court said this last Tuesday that people had the right to influence what the world could learn about them through online searches. A search engine like Google should allow online users to be forgotten after a certain time by erasing links to web pages unless there are particular reasons not to. According to the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg. Dwayne, you wrote up a whole article about this for the Drill Down.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing about it is that it's a relatively complex issue. Basically, a long time ago, this guy in Spain, he fell into some debt. And in order to satisfy that debt, he had to go out and sell a piece of his property. Now, there was an auction for that piece of property and a newspaper covered it. And the newspaper, once it covered it, you know, that was 1998. It happened, right? It's public record.
Yeah.
Eventually that newspaper's documents went online. And now if you look up his name in Spain, you can find that this auction happened and he was in debt and he had to get out of it and he's out of debt and he's all fine. But he believed that the ability for people to quickly find this information hurt his reputation and his ability to like do business the way he wanted. And because of that, he said he should be able to remove that information from Google. Remove that. Like he should be able to say, hey, Google, I don't want that up there anymore. The implications of this are pretty hardcore, but the EU court said, the EU Court of Justice said that they believe that this guy's correct. And they ruled that Google, as a search engine, in addition to other search engines like Yahoo and MSN, have to do this work, have to be able to allow people to remove data from them. In addition, they don't look at just those companies as search engines. Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, anything that you can search on for an individual is something that they're saying something that you just should be able to remove. So on Facebook and Twitter, this isn't a big deal. You can delete a tweet if you need to. The issue is having other people delete your tweets. Now on Facebook, you can report it's something that you're not happy with, and Facebook can deal with that. But now they're basically saying Facebook has the ability to mess with your timeline at the request of somebody outside of your timeline, which is problematic. When you look at Twitter, you know, Twitter is a real-time search engine. They're pretty powerful. And they actually give all the tweets to the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress has a mission to capture America's story, and Twitter is able to do a lot in terms of getting all the data that people are sending and putting out there and capturing the zeitgeist of a particular moment, event, or thing. The EU is now saying that people should be able to remove themselves from that, and effectively they want people to remove themselves from history. And this is the problem, the idea that, you know, without the internet to help you navigate the constellation of material on the internet, without the search engines, to help you navigate the constellation of materials on the internet, you can't actually find anything. So unless you want to remember a whole bunch of URLs, this is one of those things that's really going to diminish the ability for transparency on the internet, the ability to find things like Cliven Bundy's talk about how he thinks, you know, African Americans were better off as slaves, or, you know, the whole Roger Sterling thing. Those guys as private citizens could have made an argument to take that content off the web before it surfaced in any kind of public manner. And that's the most interesting part about all this.
Yeah, you know, on the surface, it seems like it makes sense because, like, you know, the analog to this in the offline world, in the world of real day to day sort of business, is that if you file for bankruptcy, it's on your record for 7 years, after which point it no longer can affect your credit score. And so
unless it was mentioned in a newspaper, right?
Well, it's
that's the problem here.
Yeah,
it was mentioned in a newspaper.
Right. But the bankrupt, like in the real world, the bankruptcy itself cannot affect your credit score after a certain a period of time. And so the analog to this for this case would be that some sort of defamatory something defamatory can be expunged from your search record after a certain period of time, and it can no longer affect your social standing. And it seems like a good idea, but from what I understand, the problem with this is that then you're also bifurcating the internet. You're bifurcating the search results, and you're having a search results that are going to be different regionally. You're separating the search results by region. You know, you'll have a different set of search results in Spain for a particular person than you would.
And that's something that they've kind of done. Like, so if you go to China and you search for like Tiananmen Square on Google, well, you can't search on Google because Google backed out of China, right? But if you search for Tiananmen Square on Yahoo, you're not going to get anything. If you search for Tiananmen Square on Yahoo in the U.S., you will get something. There's definitely ways to do that. Actually, VentureBeat had a good story saying this is what it looks like when you can remove results on Google. And apparently some female in Argentina had a picture of her taken that was less than savory. And so she sued, and Google had to remove the search results for her. So when you look up her name, nothing shows up. And that nothing, that blank canvas of white on a web browser, is indicative of this idea that you can literally erase history. And while the Spaniard guy is complaining, hey, look, the bankruptcy was back in 1998, that's, you know, 16 years ago, why is it up on Google now? The issue with that is that Google maintains a historical record of what's gone on the internet. And this was featured in a newspaper. A newspaper is a public record. The court basically said, well, the newspaper is already a public record, so there's no reason to copy the information and put it on Google. If people want to go, they can always find it on the newspaper. And when the question is asked, well, how are they going to find it when you can use the search engine to get there, the court just kind of shrugged and said, that's not our problem. So, yeah, you're right. The ramifications are crazy. Obviously, building the compliance piece, building the piece where Google has to say, oh, look, you can actually ask for this search engine result to be taken down. Someone clicks on that. Suppose I click on that and I say, hi, my name is Andy Sorsini. I want to remove this. How does Google verify that I'm, in fact, Andy Sorsini? That question comes into play. So there are all these issues logistically about how to solve them. And frankly, technology can do anything these days, so it can be solved. But the overwhelming ramifications for history are that you can simply remove pieces of history whenever you want them because they're inconvenient to the story you want to tell. And that's not really where we are as a society. For the vast majority of time, let's call it, you know, there's 7 billion people today. Let's imagine that three times as many people have ever existed, 21 billion people. The vast majority of them have been forgotten. This right to forget aspect is something that we've been trying to avoid for most of our history. And now the courts have said, nope, that's exactly what we want. And to me, at least, that's a problem.
I think I agree with Dwayne here that it is a mixed bag. It's actually quite interesting because you remember the point, at least in the U.S., where people's Facebook pictures were all of the news in terms of hiring, looking at candidates.
There were businesses who said, you have to give me your Facebook password. Most businesses didn't do this, but some businesses and agencies said, I want your Facebook password so I can see everything you've done on Facebook and if you want to get this job. All the courts said that's a terrible thing. You can't actually do that to anybody. But for a while, because youngsters did not put on their privacy settings when they were posting drunk pictures or some other pictures, they could get found out for whatever private behavior they had, and that was an issue. So yeah, this was a big issue in America so far. The right to forget, this kind of legislation, it actually exists in the U.S. already. In California in 2013, a law was passed that allows minors to exercise the right to forget on social networks and pretty much anywhere across the internet for anything they posted as a minor, to kind of combat the situation that Tosin was talking about, this idea that, hey, I was a kid, I put something up, it's not good, please take it down. That'll go into effect in 2015. This is one of those things that is going to happen here in terms of that level of law. And a lot of civil liberties groups are worried that the law will be extended to adults too, so that we end up having this problem of, you know, what actually happened, we can't tell because it's not on the internet anymore. Internet is something that we've become to rely on. So whether we're talking about net neutrality and the fact that these providers are utilities, or we're talking about the fact that Google is chronicles history, our society moves forward because of the transparency provided by these search engines and social networks.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's like I said, it's double-edged sword. I'm repeating myself now, but it's like, on the one hand, I can see the need to sort of like expunge your internet record after a while, but on the other hand, it runs counter to the sort of chronicle of the permanent chronicle of history that the internet has come to become, and we've come to expect from the internet.
Yeah, I really appreciate that point. I think that's a valid point. For anyone who's interested in more information, go to thejeweldown.com. We basically did an expose on all the facets of this law, its implications, actually recent events that it would have affected.
Yeah.
So, you know, check it out.
Great write-up, by the way, Dwayne.
Thanks.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the Audible book I'd like to talk about this week is called The Big Payback, The History of the Business of Hip-Hop by Dan Charnas. Dan Charnas was an original journalist for The Source. During his time there at The Source, he built a celebrated career in the rap industry. In The Big Payback, he chronicles the rise of hip-hop culture and shows how it became so powerful in a matter of decades. He also profiles many of the movers and shakers in this burgeoning cultural movement, offering unprecedented access to an industry that continues to shake the globe. It's basically all about the business of hip-hop, which a lot of people don't really stop and take the time to think about, but how it's influenced our popular culture. Plus a positive for that book is that, you know, when you subscribe to Audible, you get one credit, and that credit can be good for a book of any particular size, be it like a 3-hour book or, you know, a 10-hour book. This book is 27 hours on Audible, and that is yours for just one credit.
27 hours.
So if you want to like bathe in the history of hip hop, the business of hip hop from the inception to the end, yeah, you're going to get a full inundation, and that book can be yours for free if you try out Audible with our special URL, audibletrial.com. Again, that's audibletrial.com for that free audiobook and 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. If you don't like that particular one, their Audible's got over 100,000 plus titles to choose from. And even if you don't like the Audible service at all, you can cancel it and you still get to keep that book for that 27-hour long unabridged book for free. I heard a little snippet of this book, and talk about like the history. The little snippet that I heard of from this book, this guy was actually talking about, he goes back into revolutionary era. Now, I don't know. I'm not entirely sure how that.
Like the United States revolution against England?
Yeah. He talks about Washington and Jefferson. I'm not entirely sure how that ties into hip hop, but believe me, it was all inclusive. So,
rhythm and poetry. I think it's well. I mean, I was wondering how you get to 27 hours of book for a movement that's around 40 years old.
Yeah.
But if you're gonna take it back to the foundation of the Republic, then and I can actually see why you would. Struggle, revolution, rebellion, all these things. Hip hop is a scion of those things. I'm interested in checking this out. Right now, I'm kind of tied up with capitalism. it's like the 700-page tome. But right after that, I'll check this out.
We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, what could Apple possibly want from Beats Audio? Take a listen to this and come on back.
It's the motherfucking D.R.E. Dr. Dre, motherfucker. You know I'm mobbing with the D-O-double-G. Straight off the fucking streets of CPT. King up the beach, you ride to him in your fleet. Whoop, the field rolling on dubs. How you feel? Whoop-de-whoop, nigga, what? Dre and Snoop chronic down in the lag. With Doc in the back sipping on yak. Clipping the strap, dipping through hood. Compton, Long Beach, Inglewood. South Central out to the west side. This California love, this California bug. Got a nigga gang of pub. I'm on one, I might bell up in the Century Club. With my jeans on and my team strong. Get my drink on and my smoke on. Then go home with something to poke on.
What's up, bitch?
Locust song for the 2000. Coming real, it's the next episode.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakan. Apple has just kicked off a big iPhone trade-in event at its U.S. retail stores that will see employees pushing upgrade offers for the iPhone 5S and 5C. Specifically, they sent out a memo to store staff instructing them to push upgrades to iPhone 4 and 4S users with increased trade-in values. They're offering up to $99 for an iPhone 4 and $199 for an iPhone 4S, with the value put towards the purchase of a new iPhone 5S. They're promoting the deal as being able to upgrade to an iPhone 5S for as little as $0. The thing I found interesting about this is, correct me if I'm wrong, please, but this is the first time that they've ever done that. Haven't they? Any sort of trade-in on old...
There was a trade-in program. There's been a trade-in program on iPhones that has existed, but you weren't getting the same value that you're seeing today. I think that what we're seeing is two things. One, Apple is looking at the ability to make some inroads into the current gray market for used iPhone devices.
Yeah.
Because they can take those devices and they can sell them, they can refurbish them and sell them themselves to developing countries or just outside of the US without any real problem. That's a big deal because the 5C and its sales have shown us that the development of a secondary telephone is not necessarily the best way. It shouldn't be the only way for Apple to develop in developing countries, right? Just making a kind of lesser version of a phone, a 5C, and then giving it to everybody else is still going to be more expensive than recycling some of the old phones. If they can get them and make them work, then so be it. And another piece of it is the iPhone 5S is an A7-based, 64-bit-based chip. And moving forward, this is what they're going for. And if they want people on iOS 8, if they want to maintain that level of control over the ecosystem, they're going to need people to move forward into these devices. And then another big question is out there. What do you guys do with your old phones?
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about this is that Apple has never – I mean, they've never sort of publicly
pushed it
or had any concern about, you know, basically their take was always, you know, your used phones, you can give them to somebody else and have them activate them, or, you know, you can – use a third-party service to trade in your used equipment, but they've never personally gotten involved. And I think it was the switch from Steve Jobs to Tim Cook. Tim Cook, who came from the supply chain background, and I think he was probably the only person that could put a focus on the previously used iPhone market.
Yeah, in terms of what I do with my previous devices, they sit in a drawer. So yeah. They have remained there for infinity. I know people who used to try.
Wait, where'd you say your phones went?
They sit in a drawer. I always have larger plans to, you know, either change them into webcam or use them for media devices, but often that doesn't always pan out. And they
where do your phones go, Andy?
I usually hand them down, or I do have one or two that are just sort of sitting in a drawer, like Tosin's, but like one of them at least I've handed down to my daughter. Mm-hmm. And actually that's
which one does she? Which
that's
one
actually
does she
use? That's actually an old one now. She has a new iPhone 5C because it was because it was $99.
Wow, I actually make I think reasonable use. I can't figure out what to do with my 3GS because I can't find any apps on the App Store that support iOS 4 where that's stopped. I'm sorry, not my 3GS, my 3G, my old 3G. But I have two 3GSs and I actually use them as data and weather stations, so they sit in docks.
Oh, interesting.
They sit in docks in the kitchen and in the desk in the office area, and they're using iOS 6. I haven't, you know, that's where they end. So when you use the swipe down screen, basically anytime an app that I'm using gets a push notification, it'll show up on those devices. So like if I miss a text message because my phone, an iMessage because my phone is in the bedroom, I'll see it. And then breaking news comes up on there all the time. And then all the stocks that I follow, those are scrolling. And then obviously the weather, the local weather is up there too along the time. So those are actually pretty useful devices to our household right now.
Mm. It's not a bad idea. Or at least like jailbreak them and be able to do a little bit more in terms of visualizations and.
Right. So the thing about this is that I was going to do the whole jailbreak thing and try to find like an awesome dashboard. But when my research on the web didn't reveal much in that respect. And then I kind of thought to myself, well, the interface is still – once you get used to a newer phone, it just feels slow to type on it and everything. I never really pick them up. So they kind of do their job. The one in the kitchen I pick up every once in a while when I'm looking up a recipe just because I don't mind if it gets a little smudge on it or whatever. But for the most part, they sit there. Now, I have an iPhone 4S, too, and that phone I sent to my mom to use. So hopefully she'll – if that's going to be her entry into the iPhone market. But I told her I want it back because I'm kind of a hoarder. I want to be able to look at a history of all these game-changing devices. when she's done with it, I'll take it back.
Don't you feel like a twinge of a little bit of you know, conspicuous consumerism when you have all these devices laid out in front of you and we're like, okay, that represents a few hundred dollars right there. That represents another $100, a couple hundred dollars.
I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, you know, like there, when I got my girlfriend an iPhone 3G back in 2008, and then, you know, I thought I was the bee's knees, but then the minute that thing felt slow, I had to get her another one. So I managed to get another one for a pretty reasonable rate that was not several hundred dollars. And, you know, that one is one of those weather stations. My old 3GS is a weather station. The way I look at it, you say that it's a thing of conspicuous consumption, but I say to you, keeping expensive electronics in a drawer collecting dust is...
Well, yeah.
Was much more of a waste than my actual utilization of these cloud-based devices now. So that's how I look at it. The 3G, I mean, it's an iPod, essentially. It's a really slow iPod. It's connected to a dock that's connected to a set of earphones, and every once in a while it can be used, but I really haven't touched it. And I feel actually bad about the fact that I can't use it. So that's kind of where I sit on that.
Moving on here, iOS 8 is likely to supercharge the functionality of Apple's iPad with a new split-screen multitasking feature, according to sources with knowledge of the enhancement in development. They say that the feature will allow iPad users to run and interact with two iPad applications at once. Up until now, each iPad application, either developed by Apple or available in the App Store, is only usable individually in a full screen view. This multiple application feature takes a page out of Microsoft's playbook, as Microsoft's Surface line of tablets has a popular snap multitasking feature that allows customers to snap multiple apps onto the screen for similar simultaneous usage.
Yeah, this also sounds a lot like it sounds a lot like the Samsung Galaxy, the recent Galaxy series of Note devices that allow you to do email while watching video, things like that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a nice improvement, even though, as you know, humans are terrible at multitasking, but we still love to do it anyway, so...
Yeah, it helps task switching easy. It helps task switching become easier as you, you know, if a video is playing on one half of your screen and you're like slowly typing an email on another, you're moving back and forth. But it's better than double clicking on a button and swiping over. Yeah. We'll see how it works. I'm interested in seeing what devices this is going to support. I don't think it'll support the iPad 3 device that Andy and I have. It'll be really interesting to see on the iPad mini. I know the mini has a tight resolution right now, but at the same time, you know, that's not a big screen for a lot of action. But you know, if I know Apple, they found some way to make it interesting. But it does sound like things we've seen before.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is one of those cases. If that's the case, this is one of those cases where, you know, Apple is always quick to sort of position themselves as the leader that other companies copy, but this is one of those cases of Apple following trends that others have set before.
Absolutely. And if we think about it, in the last several years, we were talking before the show, I think we're gonna have to put something down on the drilldown.com about this. In the last few years, I don't know that we've seen Apple truly leading in the space. And, you know, you're talking to people who – and this is coming from people who admittedly have multiple iPhones in their homes. I mean, let's look at it. We've got the new iPhone that's supposed to be coming out, 4.7 inches in August and 5.5 inches in September. Those are the rumors. I mean, we've seen these large format phones before, not from Apple though. The small format tablets, you know, like the iPad mini, I mean, that was a complete reaction to the Nexus 7 and the Kindle Fire. We look at these meaningful voice interface and recognition software pieces like Siri and Google Voice. I mean, those came out pretty much in tandem. Not Google Voice, Google Voice Commands came out pretty much in tandem. When it comes to maps, you know, Apple decided to push Google out and follow, and they haven't followed so well. I think the Maps app on the Apple system is really good now, but it's just been playing a game of catch up the whole time. Social integration is another thing that we've seen Apple have some struggling with. And then now you've got the split screen multitasking, which has been available on the devices from Microsoft and devices from Samsung for some time. When you throw in wearable technology that other companies have led the path on, it becomes a long list of items. And then, you know, finally, we look at Apple and its interest in streaming music services, which I know you want to talk about later, and the fact that those showed up in other companies first.
Yeah. Yep. And speaking of, jumping right into it, one of the biggest stories of the week now, at least rumors. Usually I don't like to give too much
credence to rumors.
Yeah, because there's plenty of time to talk about it when they actually do announce it. But this one's, I think, is potentially important enough to talk about. People in the entertainment industry have long wondered what Apple will do with all of the money that's in its bank accounts. They're sitting on cash and investments totaling about $160 billion. With that money, they could, amongst other things, they could buy out the largest entertainment company in the world, Disney, which is worth $145 billion with little or no borrowing required. They could acquire all the major record labels, or at least as many as...
The DOJ would allow.
Yeah, and still have plenty left over. But it's rumored that they're doing is interesting. They're biting the bullet and allegedly writing a big check to acquire another established player in the music business, Beats Electronics, founded by Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. which first made its mark selling super high-end headphones. But it's not something that, you know, the headphones aren't something that Apple couldn't develop itself. So the question is, what is it that Apple potentially wants with Beats Electronics?
I feel like I can answer that for you.
Take a shot.
So Apple Beats, $3.2 billion. The question is why? I mean, we think of Beats as a headphone maker, but Beats has a secondary business, and that's this Beats Music streaming music service.
Sure.
Apple has been tied to music ever since it emerged from the ashes of the 90s, right? They showed up with the iPod, which was not the first MP3 player, but arguably the easiest for customers to use. A couple of years after that, Apple showed up with the iTunes Store, which made it even easier for customers to use. And so they dominated this music space. And the domination of this music space has had allowed them to put these devices in people's pockets. iPods moved iBooks and the other laptops at the time, other devices at the time, because people wanted that connectivity. This is what moved Apple, the ability to give people entertainment in a digital space. No other time in the world if people say, I want less quality in my music because it's more convenient for me to have it on an iPod. It's huge. Years passed, you know, 2001, the iPod comes out. 2003, the iTunes Music Store comes out. 2006, people are starting to say, well, you know, I have a phone in my pocket. I have an iPod in my pocket. Why can't I just put them together? In 2007, Apple unveils the iPhone, and it's the fact that you can take your music collection, have it on your phone as one device, and use that. That's really what drove the original iPhone push. People wanted that iPod feeling in their phone. But since then, on the music side, Apple hasn't been too innovative. They've they tried Ping in 2010. That was a social media service that was supposed to connect to Facebook and let people know what you were listening to, and it didn't really work out. In the meantime, you had RDO and Spotify and Turntable.fm and Pandora really take rise. Pandora had been there forever, but it really took rise like in 2006, 2007. So Apple, you know, has made moves in music, but basically the model of buying a track from the iTunes Store is not something that's experiencing a lot of growth. We talk about peak oil when it comes to the amount of hydrocarbons under the earth. Apple's hit peak download. It's plateauing now. There's no really new growth.
They haven't made terrific inroads into streaming either. Their iTunes radio isn't.
Right, so that's what they did next, right? So they said, okay, people aren't buying the music necessarily. What are we going to do next? You know what we'll do? We'll let people stream their own music.
Yeah.
We'll buy this thing called Lala, and your music gets uploaded. Whatever we have in our system, we're going to give you access to, and whatever else you have that we don't have, we're going to put on the cloud for you for $25 a year. Boom, you're good. And, you know, iTunes Match is a reasonable product. It's, you know, there are other guys that do that maybe slightly better, slightly worse. But, you know, that was a thing, and people were like, okay, I can try this. But it wasn't the blow away, I love this thing kind of product that I think Apple was hoping for. So what they do next? They looked at what was around, and frankly, Pandora has 70 million active users, and they said, look, we want 70 million active users. The fact is we can build this directly into our music app. So they split the music app from the podcast app, and boom, iTunes Radio is just sitting there, and it's the ability to stream stuff based on the stuff you've bought on Amazon, on Apple's store, and the stuff that you were able to tell them that you like, just like the Pandora type stations. And it hasn't experienced a crazy amount of growth. Now, obviously, it's being used, but there's nothing on the internet that will tell you that Pandora has suffered a big hit because Apple moved into this space. The lunch wasn't stolen, and Apple isn't growing by leaps and bounds. What is interesting and growing by leaps and bounds is the hype, the buzz, and the usage of these streaming services. Services like Pandora and RDO, where you can go in and for $10 a month, you don't own any music, but it has a Netflix-like model where you can access anything that they have in their catalog. And people really seem to like that. It's not for everybody, but when you look at Google Music, which has the same features as Spotify, it actually has everything that Apple Suite has. You can buy your music, you can create a station and play it, you can upload your own music and play that, and you can have a streaming music service. Apple is buying Beats to get that piece. And one of the reasons they're buying Beats to get that piece instead of and creating it themselves is because Beats has this really interesting technology for creating a playlist. It's called The Sentence. If you go to the Drill Down Podcast and look at our Beats article, there's a link to Joanna Stern's great little video review of it, and it does really well. It's a quick and dirty means to say, I'm leaving work, I'm walking home, I want to listen to something upbeat, and I want to hear stuff by this artist. And it's a sentence that you put together on the fly on your phone. It goes out to the Beats service, figures out what music you want, and it throws it right at you. And the playlist that it creates is pretty effective and pretty magnetic, and that's what Apple has been looking for. In addition, with the Beats brand comes Beats users, hopefully.
Yes.
And even though they have 200,000 users, which isn't a crazy amount of users, they do have a demographic on the hardware side that Apple is interested in retaining. You know, back in 2001, it was those 21-year-olds and 21 to 30-year-olds that were spending their money, $400 on an iPod, right?
Yeah.
Those same people today and younger are getting their parents too, or they're spending money themselves on these $300 headphones. Apple, I don't think, is crazy interested about the $300 selling and developing $300 headphones, but they're not opposed to it. But getting those people on the subscription service and getting those people thinking that Apple is cool again is a big thing. Right now, when you're a youngster Absolutely. And you walk into an AT&T store or a Verizon store, you see, you know, Samsung Galaxy this and HTC One that and a whole bunch of other devices that are available for very little money or no money and are available almost sometimes off contract. And that's not the iPhone way. If you want an iPhone, you've got to spend $100 to $200 to get something close to new. And if you want something for free, you're going to get something that's at least 2 years old. Those guys don't want old. They want new. And by hooking this up, especially if it's exclusive to Apple – Apple is going to begin seeing people want to move back to Apple and what they're doing. So that's another piece of why Apple really wants it. Beats also is one of those few acquisitions today that has a revenue plan tied to it. It's $10 a month, and that's what it is. And people are willing to pay that money. So
I think
there are a few reasons to get in there.
I think you summed it up really nicely. And also quite interestingly, you know, these are the users or people that will pay, similar to, you know, the first adopters of the iPhone, you know, quite early on, where the market was really these high end users or potentially even power users who wanted that same sort of quality and were willing to shell out the money for it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, Bloomberg Business Report says that, and this is what I found like most interesting about this, and I think probably the most compelling thing to Apple is they say that Apple executives were impressed by the rate that users were rapidly converting from their free service to paying subscribers. And that was what was appealing to Apple about Beats. And I can
make no mistake. Apple has long been the most effective at moving people from free to paid, whether it's the way the App Store works and everything to, you know, iTunes, Mac, things like that. They're really into that. And again, like, I think you hit the nail right on the head, Andy. That conversion is really important to them. They want that revenue.
Right. And they have it in other spaces, but not in in streaming music up until this point. And I think that's the key. It was an acquisition for the conversion.
And let's not forget the radio, the music companies. They're behind this too. Right now, you know, there's a lot of complaints in the marketplace about how the cost of the music is artificially held low at 99 cents or 129. If you can get these people to pay these subscription fees, they're getting more cents per play than they would otherwise over time. Because when something's hot, they're going to get a lot of revenue from that right then. And, you know, stuff in the catalog that's older, they're still going to see something. And these services are also great because they cut down on piracy. People just want to spend $10 a month and not have to deal with storing music or getting the best quality music or whatever. And, you know, while Beats arguably doesn't have the best audio quality in its headphones and stuff, it does have an audio quality that demographic enjoys. It's slightly bassier. It's slightly more heavy-hitting. And, you know, Apple could stand to have that kind of differentiation in its product offering.
Oh, here's an interesting factor to this whole situation is that rumors have it that when Apple does complete this deal, that Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre are likely to take senior positions with Apple.
I heard of that about Jimmy Iovine. He'd be running the content piece of that. I have not heard that about Dr. Dre. While I imagine that he would negotiate some ceremonial emeritus type role, I don't think that Apple's the type of company to get a global creative director the way that BlackBerry picked up Alicia Keys.
Or Polaroid with Lady Gaga.
Right. I don't think that's their style. Although if they think that could pull in young urban people, then, you know, it doesn't cost anything really, except the however, you know, a couple million bucks it's going to cost to have them on the role in the role for a few years. But, I mean, the fact is Dr. Dre's already bragged that he's the first billionaire in hip hop, although I thought that was Master P. and if that's the case, then, you know, he doesn't need to work. He can work on the next thing.
Yeah. I thought that was hilarious. You saw that leaked video.
Yeah. I do wonder. I mean, like, obviously, there's been no official announcement from Apple, but that does not look like an April Fool's joke. Although on April Fool's, there was yet another rumor that Apple was in talks to buy Beats, which seems to have been confirmed by the Financial Times, which is why we're talking about this. So there, I could see Tim Cook kind of like putting his head in hand and being like, "Oh, damn."
so much for secrets.
Right. So much.
Well,
for like,
now he can just slip on his headphones.
Exactly. But that's one of those things where, you know, I'm sure if they could have helped it, they would have liked to have announced that kind of thing at WWDC 2014. But, you know, with the Beats system being what it is, with iOS 8 coming out later, I think for me the only big question is Beats going to be solely integrated into the Apple iOS 8 operating system? Or is Beats going to remain on its own the way Facebook has dealt with Instagram, the way, you know, Yahoo has dealt with Tumblr? That's the big question for me. Because if it's tied into iOS 8, that's going to either compel users to hop on iOS 8 and get those iOS devices, or it's going to lose traction. You know, there might be some breakage. So it's interesting to see what they'll do. It's got a brand, and the brand is high-end, and the brand is high fidelity, and to just throw that away also doesn't seem to make the most sense. So I don't know what's going to happen. I think that they might leave it intact for until later. But then again, iOS 8 isn't coming out until August. So,
yeah, I mean, do you think there's enough time for like an actual
product integration,
quality integration? Because Apple tries to do things well without, you know, not rushing a product out on
that's true. They did buy Siri in 2010 and they didn't release it until late 2011.
Well, they made announce it like with the it's like what they did with Lala. You know, they announced that they'd purchased them and then we didn't hear anything about it until
they shut it down and we never heard from it again. Yeah. They can't do that with Beats. So the thing is with Lala, Lala's brand was tiny and they shut it down and they integrated it in over the next like year or so. With Siri, they also shut that down and they integrated it in. With Beats, the idea that they'd shut down such a service that is growing and lucrative and that has a strong brand seems like not the best idea financially, especially because they're such, you know, they're money people. That's the thing about Apple. A lot of companies don't know how they make their money. Apple and Google really do. Those guys know what's up.
One last thing I wanted to say about this. I think it's fairly clear that Apple wants Beats electronics for the Beats music streaming service. However, I will say that up until this point, Apple really hasn't developed any over-the-ear hardware headphones. I mean, they got earbuds.
They have two types of earbuds. They've got the EarPods, which were the big revolution in 2013. Hey, man, we had to make new EarPods because the old earbuds weren't working.
Right.
And then they've got the in-ear earbuds that retail for almost $80, I think. So they haven't had any over-the-ear or anything.
Nope.
You're right. And what they do have, you know, I was talking to Devinger about this the other day, and he's not too impressed with the current quality of the headphones that they put out. That Beats is awesome, but Beats is better.
Beats, yes, but but I will say that Beats audio, I mean Beats headphones, are probably more hyped than they are
good. I know they've gotten better over time. And you know what? When Apple first came out with the iPod, that was the complaint too. The quality isn't as good as other media players. But I think over time they got decent enough for people to stop complaining. I do know that with Apple's backing, Beats can now create the best headphones in the world if they wanted to, right? And, and probably hit margins that are pretty nice to look at as well.
Maybe.
But well, we could also see new iPhones shipping with Beats headphones, Beats earbuds, which is a possibility. It's just unclear what's going to happen with that brand. It's a young brand, but it's got hipness to it. It's got cachet, for lack of a better word. So,
and one last thing I wanted to bring up about this is that do you feel like this is an example of Apple chasing trends rather than being on top of them? We briefly talked before the show about how Google had hit all of these nascent markets and they were on top of them. Wearables and cloud services. And you mentioned a couple others, Dwayne. But this feels to me like Apple is sort of chasing. They're a little behind the trend.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're right now. I think we have a list of 9 things. We'll put them up on the drill down later. But I do feel as if you look at the Google Music solution, and Google clearly chased everybody when they put that together, right?
Yeah.
So it's not fair to say Google was running around and beating them first, but they did put together the whole package, the quadrifecta, let's call it. You've got your own music up there. You've got the ability to stream music of your choice. You've got the ability to purchase music, and you've got the ability for the computer to just make a radio station for you and go forth. Apple's going to hit the quadrifecta this year with Beats. Whether it's built into the music app or not, that'll be the question. Google's already got that. When you look at Spotify and Pandora and Amazon, they're all pieces of that quadrifecta. And the fact is, we'll wait and see if people like being dialed into just one thing, or they like having their kind of different segments. I know a lot of people are big fans of Spotify, but I also know Spotify isn't pulling in the kind of revenue that they really want. And one thing that Beats does get out of this is that it can grow what's typically a slow growth business, streaming media, to something that is sustainable with the backing, the financial backing of one of the most powerful and moneyed companies in the world. So we'll see kind of how that happens. Beats is going to have to compete. But I think when you think about Spotify, a lot of people think indie rock, discovering music, that kind of thing. When you think about Beats, people think hip-hop. They think R&B. They think Justin Timberlake. They're not thinking about sort of some of the new wave of kind of hipster classiness.
Yeah, quickly touching upon one of the points that you made, you know, I think there are a few companies out there that are really good when it comes to audio, but they don't have the same sort of marketing backing and panache that Beats has. That's really where Beats been able to find their sort of popularity and also, you know, display themselves on celebrities all over the place. Yeah, that's where a lot of, you know, youngsters look up towards and like, oh, you know, such basketball player has these headphones. I need to get a pair, you know, that sort of thing.
No, you're right, because if you look at it, the company is Beats Electronics. The streaming service is Beats Music. But the hashtag is Beats by Dre. These guys know how to market, and they know how to market effectively.
Yep, yep. All right, we're going to take one last break here, and when we come back, our drill down video of the week, it's adorable. You're not going to want to miss it. So take a listen to this, and come on back.
This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum. This is the best burrito I've ever eaten. Yum, yum, yum. With plenty of beans and plenty of cheese and plenty of rice. Oh, isn't it nice? Yum, 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 yum.
You're listening to The Drill Down.
Yum, yum, yum.
I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Are you ready to become a Google Glass Explorer? You've got the chance from here on out, I think. A while back, Google opened up their Explorer opportunities to buy Google Glass for one day only to the general public. And according to a post here on CNN, they're going to be opening it up for forever, for everybody to, as long as supplies last. Anyone in the U.S. can buy one on Google's online store.
Yeah, you know, I saw this, and I got, you know, I got to say, like, when it first came out for that one-day sale, it seemed, okay, they're testing it, maybe whatever.
Yeah.
Now I feel as if the reason they're saying while supplies last is because between their partnership with Warby Parker in 2013 and the fact that obviously this technology has changed and they have whole teams working on this is a big deal for them. They're taking this first generation of glass and they're putting it out to pasture in order to come up with something that is a little bit more accessible, a little bit more affordable and robust. You know, I think that's a big piece of it. Better camera, better battery life, all these things are things that they can do with larger scale production and, you know, the time and lessons they've learned over the last year with this device.
Yeah, I feel like this, it's an interesting point because it always felt to me like $1,500 was not going to be the final price point for Google Glass. Like they were going to, like $1,500 is the developer version. And then when they finally open it wide to the public, that it would be at a much lower price point and with a better, more refined electronics. So that's what seems weird to me about this announcement about them opening it up to everyone for $1,500. And I think you're right. I think that makes
they want to unload it. And there are people who will pay the $1,500 for it. It's I mean, if glass becomes what Google wants it to become, it's going to be a piece of history, and this is going to be one of those tech gadgets that people are going to want to have on their little museum shelves or whatever. It's got its own culture around it, and I think that's what works. I think they, despite my earlier misgivings, what they've done with it culturally on the marketing side has moved people. People are thinking about it. And when they did sell glass on that one day, they sold, you know, a lot of units. There was a lot of demand. But that demand was pent up. That demand was people who weren't allowed into the Explorer program. That demand was people who'd been waiting for some time. We'll see what happens now with supplies last. We also don't know how many supplies there are. There could be four pairs left. Who knows?
Yep. And then I can't wait for the final, you know, the actual release with the better electronics and more refined integration into the service. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they can get a finished product ready for consumers, they're going to be in a good. They're going to be in a very good place because they're years ahead of anyone else, including Facebook with Oculus Rift.
Yeah. Although it's a different sort of technology, Google Glass is a tiny screen, information screen in your eye line, and Oculus is full and total a virtual reality, augmented reality.
It's true.
All right, and for our drill down video of the week, probably the most adorable video that you will see in a long time, and it's probably the most adorable one that has been on the show, maybe even ever. We've had some adorable videos in the show, but this one I think takes the tiny burrito, and it is of course a tiny hamster eating tiny burritos. Where does this video come from, Dwayne?
I mean, it comes from this little company. What is their name? It's called Hello Denizen. It's got almost 7 million hits so far. And this video is literally a guy in his home who decides to make a culinary experience for a hamster or two. And he makes a little table, he makes a little setting, he puts up a little light, and he has these hamsters eating burritos at you know, a table with a tablecloth. The table's made out of a poker chip. It's a whole thing. But it's definitely worth checking out because you'll think that the absurdity of this video the high production values and the absurdity of the content make it just one of those things you just have to watch.
There's two incredible things I love about this. One of them is that he actually serves the hamster these burritos with a pair of tweezers, which is just adorable as hell. And secondly is when the hamster is eating the burrito, his cheeks just sort of puff up. Just a freaking adorable.
Well, he's also, as he serves the hamster to the burrito, he's actually holding his hands in prayer, like position, nervous that the hamster may not like the burrito.
Right.
It's just a happy space to be in.
Yeah. All right, so that's going to do it for our show, with the exception of going around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your presence on the internet when you are not here on the Drill Down?
When I'm not recording the Drill Down, you can always check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also check out what I'm writing on thedrilldown.com.
Yeah, this week you have two phenomenal articles, both regarding the Apple Beats rumors and the Google EU ruling.
Yeah, we're just trying to like make sure that it's more robust and people can go in there and take a look. Everything we do, we try to back by as many as many sources as possible from outside of our perspective. The stuff that we're reading that we bring into the show, we use that to buttress what we're writing on, and we can get into that in more detail. So that's kind of the focus, and that's where you can find me week to week.
Tell us, and how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. IRCwebcast.blogspot.com. Actually, this weekend, I'm going to be at the Maker Faire in San Mateo in California. This is a fairly large event here in California, so if you're around, feel free to stop by the R2D2, the Astromech booth, where there will be a bunch of droids, and I will be there this weekend. As well as you can see my updates for my particular droid at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
So are you're going to be like showing off your work on your R2D2?
He's going to be drooling over other people's work.
Yes, more or less. I will not. I did sort of have plans to bring my dome, but there's still a bit of work I need to do on it, so I don't want to make
it. Save the dome. There'll be plenty of time.
Yes, but I will be helping other people with their droids. As well as, there as a support and just, a learning experience. My first Maker Faire here in California, so this is going to be fun.
There you go.
All right. Cool. If, like Dwayne, you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issues that pertain to technology, social media, or geek culture, you can send your story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on our site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And as always, be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
The Drill Down.
Smoke weed every day.